All this is Dr. Mobeen Sayed from drbean.com. Today is a super exciting day. This day has come after many, many weeks of waiting. We have the beloved, the awesome, amazing Dr. Zelenko with us. Dr. Zelenko has been treating COVID-19 patients in outpatient setting for, I believe, now months now, and successfully. And not only that, he is an outspoken, brave leader for the cheap and inexpensive treatment with hydroxychloroquine-based protocols. So, Dr. Zelenko, welcome. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
So first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm sorry I didn't come on sooner. I had some issues come up. But I am 46 years old. I've been a family physician for 20 years, educated and trained in New York. And married, I have 8 children. And I grew up in New York, Brooklyn, even though I was born in Ukraine. I was born in Kiev. And my family emigrated when I was 4 years old to Brooklyn. So, that's my kind of a quick background. I've been a family physician for a large community of 35,000 people. Wow. And they all live within a square mile, very high population density. Hmm. And that's how I got kind of sucked into this COVID pandemic. I didn't choose it. It chose me, because my community got hit in the beginning of March, and everyone got sick at once because of the population density. And my office, instead of seeing 50 patients a day, which was the average, we were seeing 250. And all the outpatient services, like the laboratories and the imaging places, the radiology, were all closed because of the pandemic. So, and half my staff got sick. So it was a war zone. It was the way that I had to practice medicine completely changed overnight, where you had to rely on intuition and triage and just common sense. You had no resources. So it was like as if a bomb went off and you have multiple casualties and you're understaffed and you just do the best you can. So it was a disaster. And what were we offering patients at that time? If you remember, the whole world at that time was focused on respirators. We need more respirators. No one was talking about pre-hospital intervention to help people so that they don't need respirators, which didn't make sense to me, because that's what we do with every other condition, right? So I started doing my research, and I looked around what different countries were doing. So I looked in the Far East, South Korea actually, and they were using hydroxychloroquine and zinc, some mild success. And they were using it in inpatients. Then I looked in France, Dr. Dudé-Raoul in Marseille, he was using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin with some success. So I realized, but I found myself in a different setting. I was in an outpatient setting. I'm not a hospitalist. I'm not treating patients. My job is to keep people out of the hospital. So I decided, well, let me make a regimen. Let's see how things go. Trial and error, you know? And so I combined the Far East approach with the French approach. So hydroxychloroquine was the common denominator. Azithromycin, the most common antibiotic I use. And zinc is just an element. I mean, so I had the 20 years experience with the hydroxychloroquine. I've been using it for my rheumatological patients and for my patients that travel abroad to endemic areas where malaria is. So I would give them for prophylaxis. So it was a drug that I was very familiar with. And I used to give it to pregnant women and to children. So all these drugs were safe and known to me. They were cheap and they were available at that time. So I combined it into like this three drug approach. But more important than that, I developed selection criteria or risk stratification criteria to choose the patients I'm going to treat. And the reason why I did that was, if you looked around in the hospitals, I was looking at who are the people that are dying. So it was the people over the age of 60, or younger people, but they had other problems, they had comorbidities. That's it. So I looked around and said, okay, this virus is not killing people equally. It's picking on the vulnerable. It's attacking those that are sick and old. And I looked at all the young people that were getting it, they were all getting better without any intervention. So it made sense to me that with the limited resources that I have, I'm going to triage the high-risk patients. And then, more important than anything, was to intervene immediately based on clinical suspicion and not wait for confirmatory testing. And that was very simple. Why? Because if you look at the viral load dynamics of COVID, the first 5 days of symptoms, the virus essentially is constant in terms of concentration. Around day six, it explodes like a wildfire. Now, I don't know in your experience, but in my experience, most patients come to the doctor between day four and five.
Similar.
Because it goes like the first 2 days, they're sick, they think they're going to get better. The third day, they see they're not getting better, so they call the doctor, and they get an appointment either the next day or the day after that. So we're by day four and five. Is that what your experience is?
It's very similar. And as what I have seen is too, most of the cases are these within third, fourth day when they feel that it is not going away. And the second one I've seen is that when they've started doing things that we say, you know, the administrations say, take Tylenol or take, you know, cough syrups, and that doesn't work, and they become more worried and the breathing starts becoming disturbed. That is when they become really panicky as well and they start seeking help. But you are right. Correct. Majority is in those days.
So think through it. If they come to me on day four or five and I'm going to do a test, and it takes, at that time, it took 3 to 4 days to get the test results. So I have someone on day five, I do a test, and I would send him home with nothing. And when the test came back on day nine, I would call him back and say, you have COVID, we need to treat you. It was stupid because by then they were really sick. So what I decided to do is I'm just going to treat them empirically. It was easy to diagnose simply because it wasn't flu season. It was the first batch of testing that I did came back 65% positive. It's flu-like symptoms, and they would lose their smell and taste, which is pretty pathognomonic for a COVID. Not many other things do that. Absolutely. And with exposure, it just made common sense to diagnose them based on clinical suspicion. And what I noticed was, if I would intervene early within the first 5 days with high-risk patients, they stopped getting sick. They stopped going to the hospital.
Yes, yes.
And I said, wait a minute, what's going on here? I mean, it's like I fell upon a kind of formula that really made a difference. And I don't take credit for it. I really believe it's from God. I don't think it's me. And so let me give you an analogy that imagine this, you have a soldier on the front lines, a simple soldier, a private, and he stumbles across some very important maps, intelligence. And he looks, and the maps tell you where the enemy is and where their weapons are. And he realizes, you know, this could help win the war. I need to get it to the big general right away. So that's how I felt. I felt, wait a minute. I'm not stupid. I knew what I found. People were stopping to die. So I said, I need to get it to the most powerful man on the planet. So I asked my 17-year-old son to help me make a YouTube video, because I'd never made a YouTube video. And I made a video to the President of the United States. That was, I think, March 21st. And I asked him for help. I said, whatever. I said, listen, I found something. I think it's important. I need to talk to you. So the next day, his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, calls me on my cell phone. Do you understand what I call you? It's like,
yes.
So, So I started, I told him what I was doing. He was really interested. It was just the beginning, so I didn't have too much data. He said, please keep us updated. You know, and I did. And then Stephen Hahn, the commissioner of the FDA, called me on my cell phone. Then I got Rudy Giuliani called me, and he's the president's private attorney. And I did a few podcasts with him, which went absolutely viral, like millions of people started. And at that point, everyone started calling me. At this point, I've given consultations to seven governments.
I can imagine.
Countries are literally following my protocol as a standard of care. So that's how it all evolved. So from March till June, by end of June, we were kind of not seeing any more new patients with COVID. My group, my practice, saw 2,200 COVID-19 patients. And out of those 2,200, we basically stratified 800 of them as high risk. And high risk here means a 5% mortality rate. That group, 5% were dying. So if you take 800 and take 5%, it's 40 patients. You would have assumed 40 dead people and a multiple of that on ventilators. My results were 2 people died and 4 others were on a ventilator. They all got extubated and they're all doing fine. So, I mean, that's a significant, several orders of magnitude better outcome than anyone else was seeing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So then I was contacted by 2 world-class researchers, Dr. Martin Schultz and Dr. Roland Derwand. They're professors from Germany who have had many years of research experience, published hundreds of articles in the best journals. And they contacted me and they said that they really want to work together with me to bring my data to the world. And I'm not a researcher. I said, absolutely. And we collaborated together. And the first week of July, we put out a paper, which I think you have. The paper is in preprint form. And I think it's the, yeah, that's it. It was at one point, it had something like 160,000 views already. 156,000, yeah. And we submitted it now for peer review, which takes a few months. We're at the end of that process. We actually heard back from the journal. They really liked it. They needed some clarification on some points, which we're doing now. We're going to resubmit it. And I hope very soon it will be published in a world-class journal, peer-reviewed, and then could be considered legitimate science.
Awesome. Awesome.
You know, it's a process I've learned. But my point is that in the process of trying to bring this information to the world, I came across a lot of opposition, intense opposition. And I didn't understand why. I mean, I understand now, but at that time, it just didn't make sense. And ultimately, it came down to, you know, what's motivating you? Are you viewing human life as something that has sanctity?
Yeah, so I have a cat here, which, yeah, sorry about that.
No worries. So either life has sanctity because we're made in the image of God, or we're nothing more than animals, and like animals can be bought and sold, our lives can be bought and sold. It depends how you want to look at, it. Apparently, there's enough people in this world that view us as animals. So, for example, the pharmaceutical industry benefits tremendously from hospitalized patients when it comes to COVID-19.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because drugs like remdesivir and the convalescent plasma and the IL-6 inhibitors, all these very expensive treatments are reserved for inpatient care. Now, if we prevent patients from going down to the hospital, so for example, my data showed an 84% reduction in the need for hospitalization. 84%.
That is a huge reduction.
And so that means 84% reduction in the market share for drugs like remdesivir. So that was one element that the pharmaceutical industry, which has a lot of money, resources, political influence, and so on. Like if you look at FDA's, 50% of the budget of the FDA is getting in the pharmaceutical industry. And so on. So there was a lot of conflict of interest. And then it just happened that we were right before an American presidential election. And the president, it's a matter of record, came out in support of the use of hydroxychloroquine.
He did.
It's an important drug. So anyone who was against him, or many people that were against him, did not want him to have a political win. So they began to vilify hydroxychloroquine, not because of medical reasons, but for political reasons. In a sense, let me translate to you what that means. They were ready to sacrifice a portion of our population.
And I think and they are still continuing with that opposition.
Yes, they are. But unfortunately, the truth is coming out. For example, Dr. Scott Atlas, he's from the Hoover Institute and from Stanford University, he just got appointed to the COVID-19 task force. And so he made an announcement last week that he reviewed all the studies. And he said that hydroxychloroquine is absolutely safe. And all those studies that said it wasn't were garbage science. That was the term he used.
Correct.
Garbage science. Let me tell you something. This may, you may not be aware of this, that remdesivir, 6% of patients that took remdesivir developed atrial fibrillation, which is a cardiac, dangerous cardiac arrhythmia.
Yeah.
6%. 1% had cardiac arrest. 23% had liver dysfunction. 15% had kidney dysfunction. Okay. So if you look at hydroxychloroquine, and I'll be very specific, outside the ICU setting, there was zero cardiac events, zero cardiac arrhythmia.
That is true.
Even though that's what they were saying, that it can, the QT interval is going to kill you and so on. So, you know, Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister, used to say, accuse the other one what you're guilty of. Well, that's exactly what happened. Remdesivir, which literally has a cardiac problem, because 6% of patients develop AFib, they started vilifying hydroxychloroquine, which costs 20 cents a pill, in order to promote remdesivir, which costs $3,200 a treatment. So the nefarious forces that got together to cause propaganda and confusion and fear were very, very effective. Because they were unopposed for a few months. And I was like the only one that, you know, was crazy enough to...
I totally remember your outspoken messages right from the beginning when the whole world seemed to be opposing. And I do not know what, how did you navigate that time? I remember I received so many threats. I was also one of the early adapters. And I received so many threats that we'll get you jailed and we will get you, we'll have, this will happen and that will happen. And here you were leading the pack and moving forward. So how was that time when opposition was more?
Let me tell you, life experience teaches you. And 2.5 years ago, I was diagnosed with pulmonary artery sarcoma. Most people don't even know what it is. It's around 10 cases a year in the world. And they're all found at autopsy with 100% mortality rate. And through the literature, there's only around 250 cases ever reported. I guess when I choose to get cancer, I get the right one. And they thought it was a blood clot, and I ended up having open heart surgery. And they found, instead of a blood clot, this huge tumor. And it killed my right lung as well.
Oh, wow.
So I had my lung resected, and my pulmonary artery resected and reconstructed. So think about it. I went to sleep thinking I have a blood clot. I wake up, I have lethal cancer and I'm missing a lung. And so at that point, I really thought I was dying. And there were no treatments, by the way, because no one knew how to treat it. So I was like thrown into this very unusual psychological state. And so I realized that if there's no answer for something, I maybe should look for the answer myself and not wait for others. I mean, I had skin in the game. It was my life, right? So I started doing research, and I came across, you know, some interesting studies that were used in different settings, different drugs. And there was this one drug that was used in a different type of sarcoma in stage four metastatic disease that showed survival benefit. So I went to my oncologist and said, listen, I don't have metastatic disease that I know of. I mean, it was cut out. Maybe we can use this for prophylaxis. And he said to me, you know, I invented that drug, right?
Wow.
You understand? So I took that as a sign. So I ended up, he agreed. And I took that treatment. It wasn't easy. And it's still, I'll tell you, at that time when I thought I was dying, I was preparing to say goodbye to my children psychologically.
Oh, wow.
And something interesting happens when you believe that you're about to meet God. You stop fearing man.
Oh, wow. Yes.
Because you think about it, it's like it prepared me for what was to come, because 2.5 years later, when God decided that he doesn't want to see me yet. So I end up at the tip of the spear of a global pandemic where there's no treatment. So I said to myself, well, if there's no treatment, let's figure one out. That was the current theme, right? And then he asked me, how is it that I wasn't afraid? Because I was being attacked by the two most dangerous elements in the world. I mean, the pharmaceutical industry and the liberal left in America right before a presidential election. I mean, you know what these people are capable of. So I just decided that, you know, God runs the world and I'm just going to do what I believe is right. And whatever happens, happens. And I wasn't afraid. I'm still not afraid.
Oh, wow.
I just do what I think is right. And what my instincts tell me is right. And from the very first moment, I had a sense, an inner voice that said, this isn't an answer. At least part of the answer. And I saw that it worked. And my experience, no one could deny or no one could tell me that out of 2,200 patients, I had more than two people die.
So this is for the cool beans here. I think that this is the excellence that you're seeing, that here we have a physician. So there is a medical thinking in there. And then combine that with the faith. And that allows the person to become more than a human being. That makes a person a hero. Dr. Zelenko, I truly believe this. I'm not brown-nosing you. The way you have navigated this time and stood your ground and brought the world along with you has been a service that was needed at this time. I still regret the folks who, especially the medical community, that could not figure out from the books that hydroxychloroquine can work. From the studies, from the articles, the knowledge was out there. And they just closed their eyes. And there is another group of medical professionals, and I would request this with lots of respect. There's another group who would simply say that when WHO would tell me something, I would do it. When CDC would tell me something, I would do it. When FDA would tell me something, I would do it. Guys, we are all doctors. We were taught to learn and understand and think and ponder and then decide what is the best to do for our patients. And here is an example. I love it. I wanted to ask you a question in the beginning as well. Dr. Zelenko, tell me, how is your health? You've had some surgeries. How are you doing now? We are praying for you. We are blessed to have you with us. We are worried about you. Tell us first about your health as well, please.
So 6 weeks ago, I went for surveillance or routine CAT scan, which I've been getting routinely since I got sick. And unfortunately, they found a recurrence, another tumor, in my pulmonary artery attached to the pulmonic valve. And then I had a PET scan, and it also found a lesion in my left hip. And I was biopsied, and it turned out to be sarcoma. So we're dealing with recurrent and metastatic sarcoma. So I right away pushed for a surgery. Within 4 days, I had an open heart surgery. They resected that pulmonary artery, reconstructed it, and replaced the pulmonic valve. Very big surgery. And then after that, developed a complication at the site where they canalized the femoral artery and vein. I developed a very huge seroma and extremely painful. I couldn't walk. So I needed another surgery to repair that. And then fortunately, the things got better. It took me 3 weeks to recover from the surgeries, very painful. And then I had radiation for my hip, which I finished yesterday. And next week I'm starting chemotherapy because obviously it's a systemic disease right now. And we need to eradicate any residual cancer cells. So that's my health issue.
Praying for you, blessings for you, for you, for your family, as you are fighting for the patients, for the world where, as you said, a bomb has gone off. You are someone who has actually helped and shown the way. And definitely South Korean doctors who worked on it, Dr. Didi Roller who worked on it, they're all to be credited. But the way you have done for the US and then led for the world, lots of prayers and well wishes for you. And I'm seeing lots of comments from the Cool Beans here as well for you as well.
I appreciate that. It means a lot. You know, the prayers and the positive energy that I received from the public, I really feel makes a big difference. For me, it's priceless. I really feel it keeps my heart beating. And so the science, by the way, is very elegant. This wasn't random. There is a very strong rationale for what we were doing. And this will tie me into some other options. So the main issue here is not hydroxychloroquine, because it's not the main virus inhibitor. It's the zinc. Zinc is known to inhibit an enzyme in the cell called RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, or it's called replicase. And RNA viruses use it to replicate their genetic material in order to make more viruses. Zinc is known to basically stop that enzyme from working well. So the question is, why not just take zinc? Yes. So everyone knows, take zinc for a cold, right? That was a common concept. The problem with zinc is it's in dissolved in solution, it's a positive cation. It's charged in solution. And the cell membrane, it's a biphosphate lipid, basically, and it's like oil. So the zinc cannot get inside the cell. So it's not very helpful. So it turns out that hydroxychloroquine, one of its mechanisms of action, which I was trying to exploit here, is that it's a zinc ionophore. It opens up a transport channel that allows the zinc to go from outside the cell to inside the cell. So the analogy that I like to use, and you can show that picture in my Twitter, it's a gun and a bullet. Think of hydroxychloroquine as the gun, and zinc is the bullet. Now, if I give you a gun with no bullets, then you come back to me and say, you know, the gun doesn't work. The gun is broken. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
it's not because the gun is broken. It's because you don't have all the equipment. If I give you just bullets, you're going to say to me, well, that's not effective. What do I do with them? But if I give you both in synergy, all of a sudden you have a functioning unit. You have a gun and a bullet. You have a delivery mechanism or an effective substance that will inhibit the virus.
Absolutely.
And the antibiotics, which it could be azithromycin, but it could also be others, doxycycline, for example, they have a protective role because one of the main complications with COVID-19 is lung infections, pneumonias and stuff. And also it turns out that azithromycin has some antiviral properties as well. So the combination used in the right time frame in the right patients made a lot of sense in theory. And when we began to apply it, you saw the theory work. It's unbelievable. It's a very elegant and beautiful and cheap. The stuff costs $15 and you can use it at home with by mouth, right?
Absolutely. So
this was a gift from God.
So tell me this then, Dr. Zelenko. I have seen some of your tweets as well, some discussions as well. Quercetin is a zinc ionophore as well.
Yes.
So do you believe then that hydroxychloroquine plus zinc or quercetin plus zinc can also be equally effective, or hydroxy has a superiority versus quercetin?
Yeah, so that's right. So there's actually more than quercetin. There's another one called EGCG.
Yeah.
Seems to be even more powerful. It's a green tea extract. So there are certain over-the-counter natural supplements that have zinc ionophore properties. And I live in the real world, and what that means is that sometimes I can't get patients hydroxychloroquine because of governmental restrictions or whatever the reason, or public stigma, fear. So I needed some other options that we can circumvent all these barriers. And so when I came across quercetin and EGCG, I started doing research. And at this point, I have a lot of experience with quercetin and zinc. And it's very effective for prophylaxis. It's very effective in treating symptoms in low-risk patients. In other words, these patients are going to get it better anyway, but you can reduce the severity of their symptoms. However, in critically or high-risk sick patients, I found that hydroxychloroquine works much better. And there's a reason why. Hydroxychloroquine has multiple mechanisms of action.
Correct.
One mechanism is that it actually blocks viral entry into the cell. The other mechanism is that it changes the pH in lysozymes, endozymes, and affects how much virus actually enters the cytoplasm. And then also it has an effect on the cytokine release. So since it had multiple mechanisms of action, and it's been well studied and it's extremely safe, it is still my first choice.
Makes sense.
However, if you can get it, you can get it. So I use others. Let me tell you, there's been 70 studies at this point from around the world on hydroxychloroquine usage. 56 of them, were positive and showed some benefit in some way to the hydroxychloroquine, and no major side effects. 14 of them were negative or neutral. By the way, out of those 56 positive ones, 40 were peer-reviewed. By the way, you can get all this information on the Palmer Foundation website. He has a very good collection of all the data. That's where I got some of my information. Now, if you look at the 14 studies that were negative or neutral, this 10 of them were done on ICU patients on ventilators.
Yeah.
So the remaining four, so the Discovery trial from England used homicidal dosing of hydroxychloroquine.
So that was a very damaging dose that they used.
2,400 milligrams. I was using 400 milligrams. They were using six times that. It was enough to kill an elephant. So all that study proved is that if you give homicidal dosing of medication, they're going to kill a patient. So that was interesting. And then the Lancet study was retracted for outright fraud.
Absolutely. And I am still surprised that there is nothing that came out of that, meaning it created such a negative news cycle. It made people so afraid of hydroxychloroquine. And then there is no repercussions for the people who did that fraud.
Right. Well, that's the big lie. You understand? You repeat something often enough and make it such a big lie, majority of people will start believing it. That's the power of propaganda. But let me show you what that Lancet study did. It caused the WHO to make a moratorium on the use of hydroxychloroquine worldwide. And after it was retracted, there was very little effort made to make aware those countries that hydroxychloroquine should again be used.
Yeah.
And what's interesting was the United States, the FDA, which had actually an emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine in the use of in the inpatient setting, withdrew the emergency use authorization on the basis of the Lancet study after it was retracted for fraud.
Yeah, which is tragic. So this is one thing that I, so I did a video about WHO and its performance. And of course, this similar thing can be mapped in the other administrations as well. It almost seems like thinking is not happening there. It almost seems like either there is a willful ignorance or there is just laziness and incompetence that people are just not looking at things. I have a question for you. And for the cool beans who have joined here, I wanted to make sure that we also look at Dr. Zelenko's Twitter here. So this is his Twitter profile. The pin here has various protocols and links to the studies. And Dr. Zelenko, if you're ready, I want to ask you a few questions about ivermectin and about your own protocol as well. So can we talk a little bit about your protocol?
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
So I'm going to bring this up. So here is your... So these two links are present on the Dr. Zelenko's Twitter. So
why don't you go to the protocol first? So I think that's more...
Okay, relevant. So let's start from here.
Yeah. So my protocol is not medications. That's not the protocol. The protocol is a concept, an idea. It's an approach, a treatment approach, and based on common sense. So number one is you treat the patients that are most at risk.
And who do you classify as most at risk?
So if you look, scroll up a little bit. So, no, down, the other way. Yeah, right there. So low-risk patients are those that are younger than 60 and have no other medical problems. And on presentation, they don't look sick. High-risk patients are either older than the age of 60, younger than 60, but they have medical problems, or they just come to your office and they look toxic. And that's a doctor subjective sense. You know, you just don't look good to me. You know that sense?
It's a clinical approach to look at you. Got it.
What I do for low-risk patients is different than what I do for high-risk patients.
Okay.
So for low-risk patients, obviously we suggest rest and drink a lot of fluids. And then I will give them a zinc ionophore, either quercetin or EGCG, together with zinc. By the way, one caveat, for quercetin to work, you need vitamin C. There's a study on that. I give links for everything, by the way. So in a sense, I'm getting zinc inside the cell, and that I found helps with clinical symptoms. Again, let me tell you, these patients are not going to go to the hospital. They're not going to end up on the respirator, and they're not going to die. However, they're miserable. So if I can help them with their symptoms, lower their fever, make their cough better, give them a little more energy, why not? And then the most important thing is you have to have close follow-up with the doctor. You know, because if things don't progress well, then that person transitions to high risk, and we need to treat them in the high risk way. Okay, so if you look at the high-risk category, again, rest and fluids. Now, I give higher dose zinc, and then I use hydroxychloroquine, and the dosing is there.
And question for you, when you administer hydroxychloroquine, what is the kind of patient profile that you look at? Do you look at their, for example, I have been using hydroxychloroquine for 3-4 months now as well, with lots of success. But I talked with a doctor and I said, start using hydroxychloroquine. And she said, no, I need to have an ECG before, and I need to have the history of the person before, and only then. So how do you look at a patient before you decide to give hydroxychloroquine?
Well, I make my decisions based on reality and data. So I don't do EKGs because hydroxychloroquine doesn't cause any cardiac problems in the outpatient setting, only in the ICU. But I'm not treating patients in the ICU.
Correct.
So there's been zero. I spoke to a group of electrophysiologists in America. They have a WhatsApp group. It's 3,000 electrophysiologists in the country. And they queried each other, has anyone seen cardiac arrhythmias with hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin used in synergy in the outpatient setting? In the entire country, with 3,000 electrophysiologists, the answer was zero. They did see a bunch in the ICU. Okay. So I never advocated its use in the ICU. So the answer is I do not do EKGs solely because of hydroxychloroquine usage. That's a fear-mongering. If I was using remdesivir, for sure I would, because some kind of patients get cardiac arrhythmias. But with hydroxychloroquine, I found no need to do that. And since I know hydroxychloroquine is safe for children, and for pregnant women, and for nursing mothers, so I use it liberally if I feel it's indicated.
Got it. So you have the rest, oral fluids, elemental zinc, hydroxychloroquine.
Now, if I cannot get hydroxychloroquine, which unfortunately in some states in America you can't, so then I have to go to Plan B, either quercetin. Now, but if you notice, the dosing here is much, much larger than in the previous. I use much higher dosing. And so I would use quercetin or GCG to replace the role of
hydroxychloroquine.
And then in terms of antibiotics, I either use azithromycin or doxycycline based on, you know, patient preference and or history of allergies or tolerance.
Got it.
Now, to answer your ivermectin question,
yes.
As things have developed, I have modified my approach because I don't believe that it has to be the Zelenko protocol like it, because I invented it. That's not the point. The point is that the best treatment available should be given to patients, regardless of who gets credit for it. So doing my research and seeing studies and speaking to other physicians, I found that ivermectin 12 milligrams one-time dose has tremendous clinical benefit in some cases. And then budesonide, which is an inhaled corticosteroid. And I sometimes use dexamethasone. There was a study in Europe that showed that it had beneficial effects. Blood thinners like Lovenox, because one of the complications of COVID-19 is a hypercoagulable state. People clot. And then home oxygen and IV. The concept for me was to bring the hospital to the people, not send the people to the hospital.
Excellent.
So I was seeing patients at different stages of the disease. Not everyone came right away. So I would see someone on day 8 or 9, they're having difficulty breathing. And I really don't want to send them to the hospital. The pulse ox is 92. So what I'll do is I'll give them my protocol. And on top of that, I'll blast them with ivermectin, give them dexamethasone, put them on Lovenox, give them home O2, give them home IV if I need to, give them budesonide, and follow them like four times a day.
Hmm.
With this approach, I've not admitted one patient in the hospital in months.
So a couple of, this is excellent. I love this protocol. Simple, inexpensive, to the point, and aggressive right in the beginning to prevent a patient from going to the hospital. Couple of comments here for the cool beans, if you allow me, Dr. Zelenko. I have been using ivermectin as well in some of the cases where a 6 milligram twice a day, and I give that alternatively for 1 week, alternative days for 1 week. So I have tried actually ivermectin with lots of success for 3 days in a week and twice daily for these 3 days. And secondly, I really love budesonide's idea, Dr. Richard Bartlett's idea. And I have a question here for you, Dr. Zelenko. Have you, so I want to go to your prophylaxis as well, but before that, have you seen long haulers as well? Have you had patients who would then have symptoms for months on?
Yeah. Those are the patients that unfortunately ended up on respirators for a few weeks. Hmm. They had ECMO and you know, they were slowly recovered. Hmm. A lot of them have pulmonary fibrosis. And a lot of them have, a lot of them are depressed, chronic fatigue. Some have residual effects of blood clots, like pulmonary infarcts or even strokes. So these people are damaged.
So tell me this then. It seems like the patients that you have been managing in outpatient with this protocol, they probably did not end up in that long haul state. Is that correct to assume?
Oh, absolutely. The long haul state is the byproduct of lung damage to a cytokine release that led to a variant of acute respiratory distress syndrome and a byproduct of hypercoagulation.
My apologies, a quick addition of a comment here then. So guys, I know that unfortunately many patients are long haulers. And this is an important point to take away, especially for medicos. If you're treating early, like Dr. Zelenko is doing here, if you're using a correct protocol, treating early, you can actually prevent a patient from becoming a long hauler as well by managing his situation aggressively early on. So I wanted to make sure that this comment, because long haulers has become an issue that people are ending up in that state. And my observation was those patients who were not managed early on properly, most of them start becoming long haulers. So thank you for that comment. Please, my apologies for the interjection. Can we talk about the prophylaxis as well?
Sure. I just want to make one comment.
Yes, please.
COVID-19 is two diseases. It's not one. When it's in the upper
respiratory system,
if it's in the sinuses or in the nasopharynx, it's extremely easy to eradicate. However, if it begins to descend down into the lower respiratory tree, that's when all the terrible complications begin. And this descent down begins around day 5. So the key is to kill it when it's here and not let it go here.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Thank you very much. And I really, again, I keep saying for medicos, of course, for everyone, this is very important information, but it is the doctors who are managing and they have to kind of adjust their own approach as well towards the management. I do this. I, at the very first sign of a patient, I start very aggressive treatment. And till now, 100% of the patients have recovered. And here we are seeing a similar, of course, Dr. Zelenko is the leader in this area. So Dr. Zelenko, how about the prophylaxis? This is the most common question that people have been asking.
So it depends for who. For example, if you look at the kids, COVID-19 is safer in kids than influenza. So there are certain patients that if they get it, it's a good thing. Because they have very mild symptoms. More importantly, they develop an immunity to it. And that helps build a societal immunity, or what people say herd immunity. By the way, the typical herd immunity, we we want around 2/3, 66 to 70%. Mm. However, it turns out there's a very good chance that with COVID, that number is much less because there's something called T cell immunity. Mm. There's a very strong evidence that COVID has, in addition to the antibody production in the B cells, there's a T cell component. And so that could explain why a certain sub population don't get it at all. So the point is that the more people have antibodies that have gone through the infection and cleared it, the better it is for society. Right. So these patients are low risk. Nothing's going to happen to them. And I don't prophylax them. However, if someone comes to me and says, I want prophylaxis, I give it to them. I don't offer it if they're low risk. Moderate risk is something else. These are healthy patients, but they get extremely high viral load exposure. Doctors, nurses, first responders, people in critical positions in society. So these are people that do their jobs and essential roles in society are being exposed to large amount of virus. And for these people, I do recommend prophylaxis. But it's their choice.
Got it.
Now, high-risk patients, these are people that, you know, nursing home residents, people older, younger with medical problems. These are patients that have a 5 to 10% mortality rate. This, I almost insist that they take prophylaxis. And here are my protocols for that. For the low risk or moderate risk, so I use the daily elemental zinc recommendation with vitamin C and quercetin.
Love it.
Quercetin is not available. I use EGCB. However, for high-risk patients, I'll use, again, zinc, but I prefer hydroxychloroquine. The way I do it is I give a loading dose of 200 milligrams once a day for 5 days. Essentially, it's 1,000 milligrams of loading dose, but I split it up over 5 days to make it easier to tolerate. And then after that, it's once a week. And because hydroxychloroquine has an extremely long half-life, I think it's 50 days in plasma. So if you look at the prophylaxis recommendations for malaria, for example, it's also weekly or bi-weekly dosing. So that's been my regimen. And by the way, if you look at the bottom, I bring the resources and where you can look at these things up. Everything has a source. I found almost 100% success with my high-risk patients that are prophylaxed. None of them get sick.
Excellent. So, Dr. Zelenko, I know that we are 53 minutes into it. If you allow me, some of the cool being the folks who are online right now, some of their questions, some of the questions on the Twitter, if we can do a fast round on those, would you be okay with that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, and for the folks here, I have put the links to this the Zelenko protocol. I have put the link here in the description for the study as well by Dr. Zelenko. And here are some questions. So I had announced this morning that we have Dr. Zelenko with us today. So I'm gonna go over some of the questions. So first of all, Drew from South Africa, a great friend here, and he loves you as well, Dr. Zelenko, and follows you. So his comment over here, apologies. So personally, blessings for his health, and to say thank you for being courageous and outspoken. He is dearly loved for this. Also, thanks to Dr. Sayed. So the questions, what is your progress and future plans on nebulized hydroxychloroquine? And I think you just talked about ivermectin. So I guess...
This person was listening to me carefully because I once or twice threw in that I'm working on nebulized hydroxychloroquine. I'm starting to use it in clinical practice this week already. And I'm using it in a prophylactic role in lower doses to document safety. But just to tell you, oral hydroxychloroquine, only 2% gets to the lungs. And it takes around a week to get sufficient concentration orally to have a significant antiviral effect. Inhaled hydroxychloroquine, you need like 1/50th of the dose, and the concentration necessary to kill the virus you get with one application. So its potential benefits are incredible. So you still need zinc, obviously, but so we had it produced. It had sterility and stability testing, and we have now began to use it for prophylaxis.
Oh, wow, I love that. So is this something that is by prescription as well, or people can actually find it?
Well, the way it works in America is, first of all, whenever there's a FDA-approved drug, hydroxychloroquine, doctors are allowed to use it off-label. So I'm using hydroxychloroquine off-label to treat COVID. Furthermore, there is a law that allows for a doctor to change the form of the medication. So for example, if I have a pill and I want to crush it and dissolve it to give someone, so it's easier, I can do that. So the same thing, I can make it into a paste. I can make it into a cream. So based on that law, we gave the drug, we did enough research, we have an MIT bio researcher that helped us calculate the right concentrations that we need. And we gave it to a special compound pharmacy. They were able to take the oral form and convert it into a solution of the right concentration.
Wow.
Then we had it sterility checked, obviously, and stability checked, make sure it's shelf life. And once that's ready, which it is, we now can begin to implement it in the clinical practice of medicine. This is not research.
Very important. Yeah,
because if it was research, I would need IRB approval and I would need go through all the bureaucracy. However, as a physician who's practicing clinical medicine, I am using this, and I'm not making any claims, not FDA approved. And all I'm saying to you is that I'm using an FDA approved drug off label in a modified form, and I'm offering it to patients. Those want, take it. Those that don't want, don't take it.
Got it.
In doing so, I generate real world evidence.
Got it. Next question. This is from the YouTube live. So Reality Check is saying, Dr. Bean, could you ask Dr. Z his opinion on masks?
Yeah. I personally don't use them unless the patient, well, I'll come into a room and I'll have a mask on, and then I'll say to the patient, you know, do you mind if I take it off? Or and they're, most of them are really happy just to take it off.
Got it.
Because I'm sensitive to people's needs. If they if they want to feel you know, secure, and they think the mask makes them more secure, I'll wear it out of respect for them. But in terms of prevention of spread, it depends. If you're prophylactic or you've had it and you have evidence of immunity, I don't see the need for masks. So I think, yeah, that's my answer.
Got it. Thank you. Next question. This is from Twitter. So AVOX says, how did he devise his protocol? So I think we talked about that. How come he was allowed to be a doctor and do that while others were stopped? Did he experience pressure to stop or suppression of this message?
Well, one of the things was I was self-employed. So I ran my own practice. I was my own boss. So that was very helpful because I didn't have an employer sitting on my head saying that if you use hydroxychloroquine or talk about it, you're going to get fired. So that was very useful. And pressure, absolutely I had pressure. I had the Attorney General of New York try to investigate me. And I had the Department of Justice from Washington try to start up with me. But I took care of them, and thank God everything is fine.
Very good. Next question is from the YouTube live comments. So JTJ says, will Dr. Zelenko and Dr. Bean work on a long haulers protocol, especially one that does not require prescription medication, may do not have a doctor. Many do not have a doctor.
Well, my approach for the future is to prevent long haulers. We should never have another long hauler. Regarding the existing long haulers, this is going to be a chronic medical issue. And the biggest concern is pulmonary fibrosis. So they may need, at times, steroids. They may need pulmonary rehab, chest PT, and things like that. And then more important than anything is to prevent future infections. Got it. Mean, these are not the people that you want to get pneumonia.
Correct.
So that's kind of my
approach to it. Got it. Next question from Twitter. Dr. Hussaini says, the hypercoagulability disorders are uniform process, and how can we interpret the COVID-19 cytokine storm in such disorders? The math plus protocol treatment, will it be sufficient for COVID-19 and plus one of the hypercoagulability disorder if it exists? So the question is, do you see hypercoagulability disorder uniformly, or can we predict who will become severely ill versus not?
Well, anyone who has a cytokine release, one of the cytokines, I think it's anti-phospholipid or anti-thrombin. I think one of those hypercoag elements. And so the key is to prevent someone to get to a place where they're going to generate an inflammatory response. And that's basically through early intervention. Unfortunately, it's the younger patients I've seen develop clots. I had a few younger patients, had strokes and pulmonary infarcts. So it's hard for me to predict. Many people have a pre-existing hypercoag nature, so these patients are more prone. Other people have comorbidities that make them prone. They're obese or they have a malignancy and so on. So there are known hypercoag risk factors, and throw COVID-19 on top of that, and it makes it much worse.
Got it.
And by the way, if you notice, I do use Lovenox in some of my patients for that reason. Usually these are the patients that present later, like after 10 days or they have clinically, they look very sick. So those are the people that I'll anticoagulate right away.
Got it. So I just want to clarify one comment here, Elliot Thomas, and Dr. Zelenko just talked about the long haulers. So the question is he suggesting long haulers will never fully recover? I've had very mild symptoms for 170 days and now it would be stuck for this with this forever. So I think that, and Dr. Zelenko, do you want to comment on this? This is someone who had mild symptoms, never ended up in a hospital, but those symptoms are still going on and it is day 170.
Now, first of all, I'm not God. I don't know what's going to be forever. Anyone can improve. And I don't know the details of your case. So, and it depends the nature of the damage and how severe it was, you know, because the body does have the capability to improve and heal. Now, I hope this person doesn't get offended, but there are a lot of these patients who consider or are classified as long haulers have developed depression and anxiety. And that needs to be looked into because that may exacerbate the symptoms.
Got it. So a couple of then, one comment from Dr. Dharmendra here. Just tell him to listen to some soulful music if you find some free time. So that is a suggestion for you. People love you. So they have all kinds of comments to support you and to love you. So Lisa Bowles here, her question, how effective is his protocol of prophylaxis with quercetin? Is there data that shows quercetin is as effective as hydroxychloroquine? Does this protocol need front loading? Thank you in advance. So we talked a little bit about it, the same question once more.
So quercetin is not as effective as hydroxychloroquine. Front loading, I don't think so. Although quercetin, I've actually probably used it on over 100 patients for prophylaxis. I only had one that actually developed COVID, and he was older and he had very mild symptoms. So I would say that it's reasonably good in terms of prophylaxis. I'm not so excited about using it in high-risk patients that are sick.
Got it. Got it. So one more question in the same lines. How much better is hydroxychloroquine than quercetin, assuming same dose for zinc and ZPAC?
Significantly better. Because, like I mentioned earlier, hydroxychloroquine has multiple mechanisms of action, not just the zinc ionophore, and that helps in overcoming the illness.
Got it. And finally, there is a question by Jay. What are your thoughts on bromhexin?
I'm the wrong person to ask about that because I have zero experience with it. I have heard that it's effective, and I would just suggest that you perhaps speak to someone that has used it and has more experience with it. So I have nothing to say about it.
Got it. So Dr. Zelenko, thank you so much. Thank you for leading the way. Thank you for standing your ground. Thank you for, as you are going through your own personal health issues as well, thank you for keeping saving the lives. So thank you very much
for joining us. God bless you all.
Thank you.